Our topic today is the fun one, reincarnation. Because everybody's always fascinated by this, we're especially fascinated if we can go to someone who can tell us who we were and what we did and why we did it and who we are now and how famous we were in the past. And, it's always so much fun to sort of reflect on all of these different possibilities. In the scripture reading today, Swamiji is talking to us about, it's not so much that we can reason this out, is that those who have divine perception simply look at it and see it as true. I know when I first came across the theory of reincarnation, which was in my late teens, it helped me enormously, because if it were true, it solved a lot of otherwise inexplicable facts about human life. Because if we just believe that there's no precursor to this life, and you look at the enormous inequity that is in place even from the moment of birth, and if you look at the enormous difference in consciousness and accomplishment and talents that are already in place, and you imagine that there's just sort of some random shake of the dice that this person can do anything they set their mind to, and this one doesn't seem to have any abilities at all, and this one is crippled and poor, and this one is privileged and strong, it becomes very difficult to believe that there's any kind of intelligent force at work here at all. And it leads to a kind of discouraged atheism. And if one wants to be a discouraged atheist and enjoys that, that's certainly an option. But there is this ever-driving reality in us, Master calls it the sole motivation of our lives, which in fact it is, which is to escape suffering and to find bliss. And being a discouraged atheist is not really a very blissful way to live. And it is because of our own suffering that we are driven to think more deeply about the nature of life and more profoundly about the nature of ourselves, what we're doing, whether or not the track that we're on is a happiness-producing one or not. And the difficulty of trying to conceive of any meaningful reality to life, if it begins at birth and ends at death, is that it's just appallingly inequitable. And a great many things never get worked out. Imagine somebody becomes furious at you and shoots you and you're dead. And just there you are. It's just over. Nothing worked out for you and it's finished. And it all ends in this horrible misunderstanding in which someone abuses you in a ghastly way, and bingo, that's it. In other words, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, even Western philosophers, I can't remember the famous man who said it, but he said simply, reincarnation is the only system that makes any sense. Because it allows us, it suddenly explains inequality, apparent inequality, and it also gives us endless hope, because we get to come back. As a friend of mine, when his aunt, a very wealthy woman who quite enjoyed her money, sort of heard about reincarnation at her bridge club, just sort of as a gossip, she went to her nephew, who she vaguely knew was into this sort of thing. Guess what? We get to come back, is how she put it, which is quite the opposite of how yogis think about it as a rule, or Buddhists think about it. Buddhists say, get off of the endless wheel of samsara, you know, break away from the wheel of suffering. Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna, get away from my ocean of suffering. So you don't really think about getting to start all over as a, as they say, a mewling, puking baby is such a really like such a privilege. One of my friends, a dedicated yogi, said he always meditated regularly, but after his son was born and he was there just watching the absolute helplessness of his baby son changing his diapers, and he realized that that would be his fate if he didn't get his act together. He said he started doing his kriya every morning, every night, you know, just because he could just see what was going to happen. You just have to start all over, you know, in that helpless way and finally get yourself together enough to get back onto the path. But the other side of it, quite apart from whether childhood is any fun or not, one of my friends was also saying to me, when she was about 10 years old, she didn't have any conscious idea of reincarnation, but she was saying to herself, remember, childhood is not that much fun. Remember, childhood is not that much fun, because of the experience she was having in her own family at that time. And that's a kind of a thought that we want to put out. We want to really see things as they are. But what I was saying on the optimistic side of reincarnation, which is the side that I've settled into at this point, is don't worry, you have time. Don't worry. You know, if you don't get it now, you'll get it later. Don't worry if things seem unfair. It'll all balance out in the end. Don't worry if your desires are frustrated. You'll get a chance. And when you start thinking about this life as really just a chapter in a much longer book, the book that has a very happy ending, but the happy ending of that book to a large extent depends on what we ourselves do in this moment to bring about that happy ending. It just takes all of the, it really to a very large extent, it takes all the angst out of the situation. Okay, well, I have cancer now and I'm going to die a little younger than I expected to die, but that's all right. This is just one chapter in the book. This is the chapter in which the heroine dies young of a tragic disease and gets to sort of lie on her deathbed and say goodbye to her loved ones. You know, it's really marvelous when you think about it. This is the life in which he has to face overwhelming obstacles and yet manages to remain cheerful in the face of constant defeat. This is the chapter in which it all comes together and he's the prince upon men, the mensch he's always wanted to be, you know. And then this is the chapter in which he's not. And it, but it all, in the end, we go through all of these experiences really for one reason. I was reflecting. I was in Los Angeles for a couple of days with Swami Kriyananda and heard him speak on a radio show and a satsang, various things. And over the course of this summer especially, partly I think because Swamiji's suffered a lot from sort of mysterious physical ailments one after another. So when he has been speaking, the sort of the part of him that's able to come forward is this very simple, profound devotion to God and Guru. And whereas in the past, he's astounded us with the sort of flexibility and extraordinariness of his ideas and his thoughts, when he begins to speak, the last few months especially, he tends to be talking about the same things, and what he's talking about is God is consciousness. And he tells us about when he understood that God is consciousness, how that led him to master, and how that's basically all that we need to hear. And you know, naturally, if you've heard Swamiji speak a lot, or even if you haven't heard him speak a lot, one tends to want to be entertained. You know, I've heard that before, tell me another story. I know God is love, tell me something else. You know, I know devotion is helpful, tell me something else. But the other side of it, a friend of mine who there used to be this man who lived at Ananda. He came in the very Ananda village in the very early years. His name was Honnell Cassidy. And at the time when almost all of the residents were like less than 30, he was like 65 or 70 when he came. And he was a very forceful but fixed personality. And he trained our organic gardeners. He happened to be a world-class gardener, and he trained everyone in the gardening system. Very demanding. And toward the end of his life, he had certain stories that he would tell over and over again. And they were not necessarily on the level that Swami would tell. They were just the stories of his life, and he liked to repeat them. And one of his trainees, she said every time he'd start again, she would just exhale and say, "Well, there must be something here that I haven't yet learned." And she would listen very attentively to see what it was that she hadn't yet learned. Because what was the point of being impatient? He was a wonderful soul, and he just liked to repeat the stories of his life. He didn't have anyone else to tell them to, so he told her. Well, listening to Swamiji talk about God is love, devotion is everything, God is consciousness, instead of letting the mind wander in lots of directions and wish that he would entertain me in a different way, you try to ask the question, what haven't I learned? And the reason I'm saying this is because Swami was on this radio interview, and the woman was talking to him about God, and Swami said, now here's a really thrilling announcement, God is consciousness. Have we not heard that before? But because there's so many levels on which we can learn these things, honestly, I was sitting there and I thought, God is consciousness. Like, and I just somehow felt I'd never known that before. And hearing today about reincarnation and reflecting, like, what is the essential point of the fact that we live so many times? Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to realize God. Well, that's easy to say, and Dambara today has us sing this word, you know, over and over, God, God, God. It's not such a great word in English. It's a little hard. In Italian, it's Dio, which is a little nicer, God is a little bit of a kind of flat word, and even he did it beautifully. I'm looking around for you. There you are. He did the sound of it perfectly, and we're saying it, but what are we really saying? Well, if God is consciousness, and our destiny in life is to realize God, that means that all we're ever doing is trying to have the right consciousness. Because if the right consciousness is infinite and divine, that our task then is so simple. And I've heard Swami tell the story many, many times, and all of a sudden I hear what it's about when he began to understand that God is consciousness. Because all we're ever experiencing, literally, all we ever experience is our own consciousness. We allow that consciousness to be influenced. We believe even that consciousness is being defined by the things that are around us. Naturally, I feel grief. Of course I'm unhappy. Well, wouldn't you also be mad? It was unfair. And now I'm losing everything I wanted, you know. I must feel this certain way. Or, oh, he loves me. I'm so happy. And I don't mean the capital he. I mean the little he. He loves me. And he's so wonderful. And because someone so wonderful loves me, it must mean that I'm not so bad myself, you know. But it's all just interpreting, isn't it? And then we go up and down. Or we go expansive or we go contractive. Or, you know, he stole my money, I'll shoot him. I mean, those are fairly basic consciousnesses, but that's where they are. I've been listening to this audiobook about this man who does police work. It's a peculiar book to be listening to. I keep asking myself why I'm listening to it. But it's extraordinary because he's taking me into this world of criminals. And it's his world, you know. He's a New York policeman. And the world of criminals is just so amazing. And he tells us, you know, how criminals think. Well, just what I said. He took my money. I shot him. What else would you do? Well, I suppose, gee, I don't know. Maybe I just would shoot him. Of course not. Why not? But that's because that's where the consciousness is. And it's not as if in that moment this person has ceased to be part of God's creation. That's the most marvelous thing about it. Nobody, nothing. There's nothing outside of the divine consciousness. But the whole point of living life after life after life is for us to gradually figure out what kind of consciousness really serves us. And serves us not just to get what I want right now, but serves us time after time in an everlasting way to experience bliss and avoid suffering. And you know, it's a tough teaching, reincarnation, because what comes with it is the teaching of karma. And what it says is that, you know, wherever you are, wherever you stand, it's all part of a tapestry that you yourself have been weaving by all of your reactions, and it brings you right to a certain point when there's absolutely nothing that could happen, but the forces will come together in just this way. You get on the highway, you get in a certain lane, you push the car up to 100 miles an hour, you're going to find yourself wherever that trajectory is taking you. Now, I don't think this is easy because a lot of seemingly really horrible things happen. And if your incarnation has included really horrible, seeming unfair things, especially inflicted upon you when you were a helpless child, it's no easy task to just think about the fact that some previous incarnation, some actions of my own, brought me to this position. So I accept how hard it is sometimes to really face into those things. But the fact of the matter is, it's true. Because even bad things are not given to us. Nothing is given to us for any reason except the hand of a loving mother saying, you know, if you could just learn a little bit more about consciousness, you would be so much happier. And the perfect lesson for you is to have all these forces of understanding and misunderstanding come together right here, and then we get to stand right in this spot. And everything converges, and it creates a certain consciousness in us because of our habitual reactions to it. And then we get to test out. Am I enjoying this? Am I having any fun? Is this really working for me? And if it isn't, which, because none of us are in a state of perfect infinite bliss, something is not working, then we get to do experiment. And the fun of this experiment, you see, is there's no end to it. You get to try out this lifetime, and then that lifetime, and then this one. And Master said, and it's very interesting, he said, the difficulty and the reason, and I was talking about this recently here, that we reincarnate so many times is not because it's so bad, it's that it's almost okay. And that's what causes us to keep coming back, is that it's almost okay, and we just need to make one more little adjustment, one more little adjustment, one more little adjustment. And we just keep hoping that there's something other than taking absolute personal responsibility for my consciousness. Just one more little external adjustment, and then I'll find out that I really don't have to do the real job, which is to bring my awareness back at all times to the power and the presence of God within me. This was Swami Kriyananda's first revelation. He's walking out at the ocean. He sees the ocean water flowing through the rocks. He perceives the power of the ocean represented as it did to him at that time. It symbolized and communicated to him the power of the infinite consciousness being forced to come through the openings created by the rocks. And when the openings were wide, the ocean could flow in. Where the channels were narrow, very little of that consciousness could come through. And he had this revelation that became the guiding reality of his life, which is why he tells us about it, which is, we are all that ocean of spirit, but we either narrow the channel and just a little trickle comes through, or we open the channel wide and then that ocean can flow. We are all a part of that infinite consciousness. Reincarnation, we get the chance over and over and over again to decide what kind of opening we're going to be for the infinite consciousness. How much will we be able to expand out and include all of creation? Who are we? Where are my limits? What do I identify with? And that's the other marvelous word. That's what reincarnation is about. We have body after body after body after body. And the question is, what do we identify with? I mean, here I am in this one. Is this really who I am? Am I really a woman? Am I really a man? We were laughing recently. There's a woman in India, Nirmala. Her husband, Nirmala and Dharmadas, are the leaders of our work in India. And Nirmala is a very attractive woman. She has lovely feminine qualities. She's also very strong in herself. And Swamiji and she and some others were walking in a shopping mall, and there was a dress that was not very attractive to his eye. And he looked at it, and he turned to Nirmala, and he said, "If you were a woman, would you wear something like that?" And she said, "Well, as it happens, sir, I am a woman." You know, just like this. But partly it was because who cares? And his own, Swamiji's own consciousness, you know, the people around him, you're a woman, you're a man. Truthfully, it's so superficial. And the less he himself identifies, Swami himself says, he can't even find his individuality anymore. He's just not identified with it. It's happening around him, but it's not his reality. And so he looks at others and he looks into the eyes. I had an interesting thought the other day of just how people are completely and only the consciousness coming out of their eyes. And I was especially observing that because my aunt, who recently died, she was like 87, 88, and she had weathered as people weather. And she'd always just worn her hair very simply. She'd never worn any makeup, and her whole being had become very old. She was hunched like this, her skin was wrinkled and so on. But when I looked at her, I began to realize all I saw was these bright, really bright little blue eyes that just peered out at me. And her entire being, in other words, was her consciousness, you see. And we spend so much time with all of this, you know, and but all it ever is our consciousness. And Swami had mentioned also at one point, he says, he recognizes people through their eyes. And he said sometimes when he meets someone after a long time and he meant years in this life or incarnations. He said sometimes at first he doesn't recognize them, or sometimes when he meets people that he knows really well, at first he doesn't recognize them. Then he looks into their eyes, and as he put it, they come into focus. Because that's the enduring reality. That's our consciousness. The eyes are the window to the soul. And we spend so much energy making all the rest of it look good, and sometimes we make it look good in a way that actually obscures the only part of us that really is there. And through all these lifetimes, Master says, if you want to recognize your friends from previous lifetimes, look into their eyes. Because everything else changes, but the essential consciousness is right there. And this is what we're doing. And this is the only thing we're doing. We're living through many different experiences. As Stephen was reading to us today, I wept because I was poor. I rejoiced because I was wealthy. And then I realized it was all just an ever-moving parade of dreams around me. But our consciousness is not a dream. Our existence is not a dream. Our relationship to God is not a dream. So what we're trying to do in the midst of all of this is live in the only thing that is real. And that is, we are a field of consciousness. God is consciousness. And that consciousness, to go farther, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. I mean, how many times, all of us, have we wept over this sadness and that sadness and this disappointment and the other? Once I was asking Swamiji just about this process of reincarnation, and he gave me such a simple and profound answer. He said, what draws us back to reincarnate again and again is two qualities. Because we long for something that has not been fulfilled. Or something happened that we deeply regret. And it's a marvelous measuring stick to put onto your own consciousness. Am I still longing for this? Do I live in a state of regret over that? And those are the binding, you know, in the simplest definition, those are the forces that bind us, that cause us once again to have to incarnate and try once more to overcome what we're ashamed of or to have what we want. And what we need to practice in our lives. And you see, longing is that unfulfilled desire, but regret is also this deep personal identification with our limitations. And we're no more our limitations than we are our successes. Swamiji said to us so sweetly after one satsang, he said, yes, when you do something beautiful, give God the credit. But when you fail, lay also your failure at his feet. God is especially pleased when you give him your failures. Because, you see, then we overcome that quality of the heart of shame and regret. Yes, Lord, we did make a mess of it, didn't we? You know, this is what happens sometimes. This is who I am. I get confused when the ego gets involved, as Swami said to me about me. You make terrible decisions. You know? And the ego, yeah, ouch, whoa. But I remember, and every time I make a terrible decision, I can always look back and see, oh, I just let some level of personal interest just totally obscure the truth of it. And when we regret something, that's always say, oh, look at me. I just let some personal interest totally obscure the truth. God is consciousness, and that consciousness is ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy. And the only thing we have to do, no matter what happens to us, none of it matters. All of it is to see whether God can get us one more time to fall off the truth. One of my friends, he was starting to have an argument with his wife. He was very impish. They were starting to get a little annoyed with each other. And he looked at her and he said, I'm not caught yet, are you? And that's how we have to feel when sadness, shame, despair, longing, ego of any kind comes into us. So we have to stop. We just have to look Master in the eye and say, I'm not caught yet. I'm not caught yet. And then you'll find Master will just laugh with you. Oh, my child, you're learning. Look at you, you're learning. You know? And we have endless time to learn. But why waste? A Swami once said to us, you're going to get it right sooner or later. Why waste a few million lives? And then he just said so cheerfully, ego's really easy to overcome. Just get rid of it. Just just get rid of it, just like that. Well, why not? You know, God is consciousness. We are his own. Live in that light. Bless you.